Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, June 24th. With Iran in the headlines, we talked to an Iranian-American with family in Tehran to hear about conditions on the ground. Water wars on Maui, we hear about the latest development in the fight for a long-term water license. We learn from an author on a mission to make us rethink agriculture, why he's turning to Kauai for solutions. And wait for it. We talked to a comedian from NPR's popular game show about his upcoming night at the Blue Note in Waikiki.
If you had told me beforehand, you know, this is one of NPR's biggest shows, there's 5 million listeners a week, and Tom Hanks is a guest host, and all, I'd have been in my head thinking about it.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The situation in Iran is still very fragile. After declaring a ceasefire on Tuesday, President Donald Trump criticized both Iran and Israel for violating it. The New York Times and CNN are reporting findings from a preliminary classified report this morning that the American bombing of three of Iran's nuclear sites may have set the country's nuclear program back by only a few months and not obliterated it, as the Trump administration declared in the early hours following the U.S. bombing. The Trump administration has also barred Iranian visitors and immigrants from coming to the U.S. as part of a travel ban instituted at the beginning of June. This morning, we hear from an Oahu resident with ties to Iran. Masih Gunjali grew up in Tehran, and although he left his home country with his father and became an American citizen, he still has many family members, including his mother, still in Iran. Gunjali spoke with The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about what he's been hearing from Tehran.
I lived most of my time in Tehran in southwest of Tehran, working class neighborhood. It's a very different perspective as a kid than an adult. But even as a kid, you're always aware of the war that was going on at the time and the possible interventions in the region.
Well, and you still have family and friends in Tehran, yes?
I do. My mother is there. Most of my family members are there.
And you've been in touch with them over the last few weeks?
Yes, I've tried. I keep very close connection with my family in Iran, both on my mom and dad's side. And I have a lot of friends that I still keep in contact. And everyone is worried right now. Some are still managing and some are taking it much harder. My mom's neighborhood was once bombed, so she had to evacuate. Iran's internet was shut down for several days last week. Their communication infrastructure has always been vulnerable and often compromised, even more so now. It is a fact that a developing nation under the heaviest sanctions in the world has to deal with. It's not easy. It was extremely difficult not knowing what my family is going through. But internet connection has been sporadic since Saturday, and thankfully I was able to FaceTime my family and make sure that they're safe.
Obviously, your primary objective when you want to make contact with them is to make sure they're safe. And I'm glad to hear that your mom was able to evacuate and get to safety and family was able to do so. Mm-hmm. What do you hear from them beyond those very immediate practical needs of safety? What do you hear from them in terms of how they're feeling and their perspective in these harrowing days?
American intervention in Iran is nothing new. We had a democratically elected government that was overthrown in 1953. It was successful and it changed the history of the region ever since. And in the Iranian psyche, that's always there. Sometimes people like to focus on current events and what happened recently, but it is part of a larger picture. And that intervention that is forced on the people of the region has a history that comes with it. So this is something that's been in the works for many, many years. It's not a surprise for common people in Iran.
Given what you just said, it seems clear that there would be an intense amount of anger directed at the American government. Mm-hmm. Is there upset directed at other entities involved, at the Iranian government or other actors in the region, or is it really, truly, squarely about American intervention in that country?
That's a great question. Iran has always stood alone, and it's very easily felt in Iran. It's very tangible, and people are aware of it. Now, part of your question has to do with Iranians' perception of American government. I do want to make this extremely clear that Iranians are against American foreign policy. They are not against American people. These two are often conflated and are pushed as propaganda for Americans or people elsewhere. Just because you don't agree with policies does not mean you don't like a certain kind of people. Iranians love Americans. And that's been my experience ever since I was a child. That's my experience every single time I go to Iran. That's my experience every time I meet an American who lives in Iran. Iranians are very welcoming and hospitable. And they do have the maturity to understand that American people do not reflect American foreign policy. And I think at times like this, it's very important for people to remember that.
That makes me think of a question that is perhaps the other side of the same coin, but I think it's worth asking directly. You know, in American media, whenever we talk about Iran, it's nearly always the state, right? I can't think of it reporting about Iranian Persian culture, rarely in the U.S. media. So tell us about the 90 million people who live there. What is it that you'd wish Americans could understand about the people of Iran?
They're not a monolith. People are all over the spectrum. Iran is a republic. It's not a regime. And Iranians are very capable of running it. We have our struggles and shortcomings, obviously. No one denies that. But Iranians are very capable of running their own country. Some Iranians may not agree with some things or actions that the government is taking. But what every Iranian can agree on is this. No one wants to be bombed and obliterated. We're all Iranians at the end of the day. And that means to us more than any political ideology. I, as the first generation of the republic, still believe Iranians can work it out and they can make it better. Our republic is still very young. It's only 4 decades old, and it will continue to develop and change over the years, especially now because majority of the countries is in their 20s and 30s. And these are young people full of energy, full of ideas. No government was built in a day or a few years. It'll take time. But I, and I think every other Iranian, believes that we can take care of our own country. Sovereign nations should self-govern without foreign interventions. And I think we can relate to that on this island and in Hawaii, because look at Hawaii and how it was and continues to be impacted by the U.S. intervention.
Something that President Trump has been talking about for several days now is the idea of regime change, and he does so in blunt terms. I wonder if that topic has come up in any of your discussions with people back home and how serious that threat is interpreted.
Iran pursued diplomatic means long before Trump. In early 2000s, there was a deal that was struck with the U.S. and Europeans. And there was oversight in Iran and constant inspections. And that was going on for years. And Trump, in his last term, decided that he wants to cancel the agreement with Iran. And then later he said, I want to continue diplomacy, which didn't happen because Iran's sanctions were even heavier during Trump's last term and continue to be so. And then later Trump says, we want diplomacy, and then Iran is bombed. And now he says, we want diplomacy. So it's very hard to trust that sentiment coming from someone who continues to break their promise. And I'm no political power, or you know, I'm just a commoner, but even I, when I put two and two together, it's very hard for me to trust his word.
And I'm glad you mentioned the sanctions, because I think at least in an American context, we lose track of those. I know the sanctions have been sweeping over many years, but dial down wherever you care to do so and give us a sense of the effect that those sanctions have on the real lives of Iranians day to day.
Sanctions on Iran are the heaviest any country has experienced in history, more so than Russia right now, more so than North Korea, more so than Cuba during the missile crisis. The weight of that is crippling. It makes everything difficult. I think the rhetoric is that these sanctions are against the military and Iran's political engagements. But when you look at it on paper, it includes certain food items, medicine. It's sweeping. And it's been really difficult. So, you know, there are a lot of Iranians in diaspora, whether in the States or elsewhere. And we have a hard time even sending money back home. Anyone who has old parents understands that you have to take care of them somehow. If I want to send money to my mom, I have to go through personal contacts, sometimes maybe like two or three, just to get her a few hundred dollars. It's difficult when you put that into perspective for the larger Iranian community. There are students here who have a hard time communicating and sometimes getting funds from their parents or sending money back home. It just makes everything difficult.
And I feel like one of the most important factors in such difficult times is, in fact, art. And I know you are an artist, so tell us about your art.
I think art has an immense power in showing humanity. And as an immigrant from Iran, living in the States, I see how the humanity of Iranians has been stripped in so many ways, whether it's in books, in the media, in movies. They're never the good guys. They're always bad, usually very dark. And this is something that's been going on for decades. And I've had many experiences myself with this negative image and continue to do so. But it's hard to strip that negativity from people's minds. But through my art, my photography, my theater, and my films, I've been able to show people a side of Iran that they might not have a chance otherwise. And it's really interesting, the feedback that I usually get. One time I had an exhibition at UH Hamilton Library, and someone said, wow, I didn't know you have these colors in Iran. And it really stayed with me. I was like, what do you think? Like, we're living black and white? I've heard from a lot of people that they just think Iran is desert and shacks. And when they see images of Iran, or when I show them on social media, they're completely surprised. And I think through my art, I've been able to connect to some people and show them the humanity that people have, not just in Iran, everywhere.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for listeners to understand about your perspective or what you're hearing from your friends and contacts in Iran?
This is about Gaza. This is about Israel's war. Netanyahu has been asking the U.S. to attack Iran since the early 90s and continues to do so every single time he's here. The reason for that is because of Iran's support for Palestine and Iran's stance in the region, which is opposed to foreign interventions and occupation. The foreign policy of might is right is not ethical nor sustainable. All of these wars, we're paying for it with our taxes, and the benefits of our taxes are not coming back to the taxpayers. It's definitely not America first. Why aren't our taxes being spent on us, on the next generation, on education, on infrastructure, healthcare, addressing the housing crisis, supporting the elderly, and so on? Why is there always someone else to bomb and exploit? If American government viewed other nations, other people, as valuable as Americans, as equals in humanity, we wouldn't be in such a mess. I think the world would be a better place. I think America would be loved so much more and so much safer for it.
That was Masih Gunjalli talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson about the conditions on the ground in Iran for his family and friends. We should note the nonpartisan organization Freedom House does not consider the past two elections in Iran to be free or fair.
Elected officials have heard from over a million supporters across the country showing support for public media and against a proposal to eliminate federal funding. This threat is not only real, it's urgent, and the U.S. Senate is expected to vote soon. This is Valerie Yee, Vice President for Hawaii Public Radio. Show your support for HPR and all public media. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Today on The Daily. In New York City, today's Democratic primary for mayor has quickly become an excruciatingly close contest between two candidates who are offering themselves as the solution to what's wrong with their party in the age of Donald Trump. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Rights on Maui has long been a sensitive issue. Today, Honolulu Civil Beat's lead story looks at the changing position of one of the key players in the control of this natural resource. Reporter Brittany Light joins us now. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what were you able to find out about A and B?
Yes, well, the big headline news here is that A and B, this legacy plantation company that has now transformed itself into one of the state's largest commercial real estate companies, it's stepping away from its generations-long hold on the control of the infrastructure that powers Maui's most plentiful water source. The East Maui water system that has, for decades been a source of a lot of debates and lawsuits and many things. So the fact that A&B is sort of dropping out of controlling that system is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and Alexander and Baldwin was the last sugar grower, right?
They were. The last standing sugar plantation was shut down on Maui in 2018, and they owned it. They sold the 41,000 acres of former plantation land to Mahi Pono, what we know as Mahi Pono today, a farm company owned by a Canadian pension fund. And so that former sugar plantation land is now, partially has been transformed to grow fruit and vegetables. It's diversified ag. And that company now is the sole owner and manager of the irrigation system in question here. And so It's about a 75-mile long plantation era system of ditches and tunnels, and it brings water from East Maui to the Central Valley.
Yeah, and A and B, you know, got those water rights long ago because of sugar, you know, because they needed water for the agriculture. But it is really a development company now.
Yeah, A and B has really transformed itself, and so they're stepping away from this. They're saying, you know, managing this water system or continuing to control it, it just doesn't align with who we are today as a company. So AMB says they're just simply trying to simplify, and so they're going a different direction. They're no longer the plantation company that they once were, and so now it's Mahipono that's controlling this system that, you know, is really a big issue of dispute because there's a huge call for local control of the water system, and that's been going on for some time now, but the community voice is, you know, picking up momentum and steam. And, you know, there are a lot of people who want to see public control of a public resource.
So what does the East Maui Water Authority say about this?
Yeah, the East Maui Water Authority, they are vying for long-term control of this water system. So that's their sort of role here. But what they're saying is, it's encouraging that A and B is kind of stepping out of this situation since they, you know, no longer are using the water themselves for their own purposes. But it's also concerning because now the water system is controlled by a company that's, you know, it's a foreign company. It's owned by a Canadian pension fund. So, you know, I think that there are concerns from folks that, you know, these big decisions that affect this natural resource, this public trust resource, they're going to be made now and, you know, in a different country, perhaps. So it's sort of getting farther away from the community that's vying to sort of take more control of the resource.
Yeah, and there has been this just general suspicion about, yeah, the water not being restored in the streams and the concern that it was going to be diverted for development.
Yeah, there's a lot on the line here. I mean, you know, Maui, you know, famously has water shortage issues, right? It's impacting, you know, the rebuild of Lahaina, for example. That's a different area, but still, you know, related. And so, you know, there are just lots of concerns about who's going to control the water, how's it going to be used, you know, whether or not the county is able to increase its affordable housing stock has to do with water, right? So there are just so many things that really rest on how much water do we have and how are we using it. So it's really the biggest issue.
Right, and the Board of Land and Natural Resources is still grappling with the license, you know, for that water. So we'll just have to see how that all plays out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Brittany.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking with Civil Beat reporter Brittany Light. You can find her story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
This Saturday, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Sean Conley Quartet. Enjoy live jazz performances with HPR every Saturday in June. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929 for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Kelsey Timmerman grew up surrounded by corn and soybeans in Indiana. Drive your tractor to school day was an annual tradition. But as a travel author, he likes to ask a big question and travel around the world to see how communities have addressed it. His latest book is out today. It's titled Regenerating Earth, Farmers Working with Nature to Feed Our Future. The book asks how regenerative agriculture can move beyond just a buzzword. Timmerman visited communities in Kenya, Brazil, and across the U.S., including Kauai, where he looked back on a legal battle that started more than a decade ago when the county passed a bill requiring large agricultural companies to disclose their uses of pesticides. Timmerman spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about how grassroots effort on Kauai fits into regenerative farming practices around the world.
A lot of that chapter is part of the solution. As someone put it, like the little island that could, like that faced down some of the biggest corporations on earth in terms of these giant agrochemical companies. So I reached out to some of the folks who were part of this effort in the community. I started with kind of got connected with Gary Hooser, who was a county council member at the time, who kind of introduced the bill. And then he pointed me to Fern Holland, who's now on the county council there. And Malia Chun was a mother who they pointed me to as well. If I kind of traveled around and met people, it was almost kind of like an oral history then backed up with research. And I watched so many Kauai County Council meetings from 2013. So Malia had moved into a new home with her two daughters and was starting to have like their eyes were burning and they were starting getting asthma and kind of was worse at night. She's like, what's happening? And so then she realized that there were people out spraying in the fields around her home at night. So she started to ask other people, well, I mean, these agrochemical companies are like large employers in these communities. So starting to like ask questions about what was happening was to undercut the job of your dad, your uncle, your mom, your aunt, things like that. So people weren't too keen on kind of joining her, like asking questions. And even earlier than this, there had been like mass faintings at schools in 2008. It's kind of a cancer alley in Waimea that's like along the river down the cliffside from a pioneer base. So all this had been happening for years, and other people were starting to notice. Surfers were noticing their eyes were burning, and they were noticing, hunters were noticing tumors on animals that weren't there before. It's like, what's happening? They approached Gary on the county council about, hey, can you do something about this? And he's like, well, I can't force these companies to do anything. I'll just ask them, you know, what's up, and they'll tell me what they're spraying. And so Gary did that, and he was kind of shocked at how they would not tell him anything. And so then he introduced the bill, which is Bill 2491, that asked for what was being sprayed, when it was being sprayed, and where it was being sprayed. Like what was being sprayed next to our schools, right? What's being sprayed next to our hospitals? And they were in this big fight against the agrochemical companies then to pass this bill. And it kind of plays out like a courtroom drama where all, you know, all these people come and speak out and speak for against it, and it really kind of divided the community. But ultimately, they kind of won, and then they lost, and then they won, and they lost. And the state of Hawaii ended up banning chlorpyrifos and atrazine. And they eventually had those restrictions on how close you could be to schools and homes and hospitals where you were spraying. So it's just really kind of amazing what a community can do when it stands up for itself against not just one, but multiple of the largest businesses on earth.
And I think listeners will be pretty familiar with this story, but as you were interviewing people, what do you feel like are the parts of the story that get left out or that people might not immediately think about when they think of this saga?
Yeah, I mean, I just highlight a couple people, and there was so many people. There's so many little sparks of light that kind of came together. But yeah, it is kind of a story that, you know, took place over a decade ago now. And I think that offered some interesting insight to see kind of what has happened. The footprint of the farms now has halved on the island of Kauai, and then to see also what kind of happened in the people's lives of those who I met. This was a transformational experience, not just for the environment of Kauai. It was in these individuals' lives. Like Gary saw it as one of the most exciting, most important things that ever happened to his life. And ultimately he went in 2015, went with some others to Switzerland, the Homo Syngenta, and spoke at their stockholder meeting where Gary criticizes them for selling chemicals in, you know, his community that they banned in their own.
Right now, Syngenta sprays enormous amounts of atrazine in the fields around homes, schools, and hospitals where we live. Atrazine is not allowed to be sprayed in your country. Syngenta sprays enormous amounts of blies of paraquat, which is banned here and in 36 countries around the world. And they do it daily in our community. There's four additional highly restricted chemicals that are sprayed daily around schools, hospitals, and homes where I live.
Kaina Makua is someone else that I write about. And he eventually got into running a nonprofit and becoming a kalo farmer and bringing people onto the land and teaching them how to grow kalo and what this relationship with the land means. And so like, this is much more than just like regenerative agriculture. Like when I thought I was writing this book, I was like, I'll learn about these practices and these people. It's about connection with people and place. And Kaina is a great example of that. Like we've been disconnected from the land and really from our communities where once we relied on one another or we relied on our own labor, the labor of others in our community, now there's a product that you can buy, right? There's a chemical that you can spray that does that instead of pulling weeds. There's a machine that can plant now instead of planting it on your own. You know, and kind of get to this back to this idea of food sovereignty. Kauai used to actually have a larger population of people pre-contact, and they were completely self-sufficient. The ocean was a refrigerator. They grew kalo, they traded. And now, as Kaina put it, the barges stop. 2 weeks, there's no food. And it's not just there, it's our own community too. It's my own community here in Indiana as well, like COVID showed that. And so I think having this kind of, to see the impact that has happened in the lives of these individuals and see how this community wave has rippled out and is still making a difference in the community and the lives of these people, I think is what's really been neat to see about this.
Thinking about your book as a whole and some of the takeaways, one question I have for you is whether you think there's a role for companies or anyone bigger than the community level to be part of this solution, because on the face of it, it seems like such an uphill battle if the only people who are working to fix where we've gotten so disconnected from the production of food and food systems are these small communities fighting these behemoths. So what solutions, if any, are there at a higher level to scale some of these good things up?
Yeah, I think that there is a, farmers are questioning, in Indiana, farmers are questioning the system, right? Because the cost of the inputs, the cost of the artificial fertilizer and the pesticides, insecticides, and herbicides have gone up. And the price of their commodity corn and soybeans have gone down. I mean, that kind of rises and falls, right? As one of my friends puts it, and this is someone who's like family controls thousands of acres here in Indiana, that, you know, the farmers are being farmed. And a lot of the folks I talked to, I went to high school with, who drove tractors to school, on the driver tractor to school day, whose families have been in farming for a while, they're also kind of wondering what this looks like. And they're thinking that there's going to be real small farms. It was going to be like big farms, like 10,000 acres or more. And that most of the people who work the land will just be employees of these large companies. Now, it doesn't have to be like that. I mean, the average age of an American farmer right now is like 65. So there's this like over 60% land is going to change hands over the next decade. And so like it's really critical time for people to kind of ask, what would this mean for my kids in the future? First, I'll say that I think there is this sort of awakening that's happening. And a guy near me named Jason Mock, he farms field, he plants wheat and soybeans in the field, growing at the same time. And he's grown a biodiversity of two, right? But it's like this revolutionary thing, and like people are going crazy over it. Maybe not necessarily our community, but around the nation, other people are kind of waking up to this. And there's a lot of good benefits from when you just have a diversity of two. But, you know, I also met a farmer that lives on 100 acres in Wisconsin that is completely self-sufficient on those 100 acres, turned what was corn and soybeans into like a food forest, essentially. So, yeah, you know, what is the role of companies? I don't have a lot of faith in the large agrochemical companies. Many of them now are using the term regenerative agriculture, trying to co-opt it. And basically they mean, well, you grow a cover crop. You always have something grown in the ground, so you grow a cover crop in the winter, but still grow our corn when you kill that cover crop by using our chemicals, right? So we're still selling you stuff. And I really think like truly regenerative agriculture is questioning and stepping away from or pushing against industrial agriculture. So everyone I met, that's part of it. And it's almost like this spiritual connection or this idea of being in relationship with the land and more of reciprocity and recognizing the abundance that exists, not just an abundance of one type of thing. So that gives me hope as well. So in terms of what that economy would look like, I mean, it would probably mean smaller farmers and these large agrochemical companies who I've know people who work in them, right? Those people are not evil, but collectively the action that happens, and I think this is a great example of why I want people to read the chapter on Kauai, is like you can make up your own mind then to see are the evil, not evil, the collective action that happens. There's a map on Regeneration International that you can go to and you can find pretty easily, and you can see regenerative farmers in your community. Visit them. Most of them would be happy to have you come out there and support them. This could be a way for us all to live happier, healthier, more connected lives, as opposed to being disconnected from our food, disconnected from our land, disconnected from one another. One last important thing is that sometimes, as we're talking about regenerative agriculture now, it is seen as this new exciting thing being practiced by white farmers. And it's not a new an exciting thing. It's an old exciting thing that we're remembering. And especially in Hawaii, the resilience of the Native Hawaiian population to remember and maintain their culture and their language through a lot of effort and to remember how to connect with the land is pretty critical. And I think that we all need to start to think, like, how do we grow roots where we live? What can we learn from others, other people groups that have longer roots? So for this book, I traveled to Kenya to visit with the Maasai, traveled to the Amazon with the Tupinamba. I wasn't thinking I was going to spend a lot of time with indigenous people, but I think there's a lot to learn in that way of relationship with the world and our communities.
That was author Kelsey Timmerman and HBR's Maddie Bender. Timmerman's book, Regenerating Earth, is now out and available wherever books are sold. And HBR did reach out to Syngenta for a comment, but did not hear back. Comedian Alonzo Bowden is performing for just one night at the Blue Note in Waikiki on Wednesday. Many radio listeners will recognize Bowden as a regular on NPR's weekend show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, where he appears with other comedians like Paula Poundstone, Mo Rocca, and Faith Saley. The conversation C.W. Gibson talked to Bowden about how comedy has changed since he got into the business and how the popular radio show finds humor in current events.
I used to be in aerospace. That was my first career. I was an airplane mechanic, and then I got a job training mechanics. I could always be funny, but I had never been in front of people. So when I started teaching and I was in front of the class, a situation that makes most people nervous was actually the most natural thing in the world for me. So I was a very funny aircraft instructor and decided I would try comedy, and I took this comedy writing class, and I did my 5 minutes, and it was at the same time I was being laid off, which is the nature of the aerospace business. You get laid off all the time. So after the 5 minutes, I was hooked, and I made a deal with myself to never work on airplanes again, and so far I've been able to maintain that, but I do still have a toolbox in my garage.
So you've performed your comedy in various places around the world, but we know you so well from public radio. Did you grow up listening to public radio, or is that something that came later in life for you?
Well, the story with Wait Wait is very funny because I did listen to NPR. I'm a news junkie. That's just a natural thing. I grew up reading two newspapers a day. We got a morning and an afternoon paper, and it was just a thing to read the news and know what was going on. When I was invited to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I had never heard of the show. I had no idea what it was. My agent told me it's a news quiz show. That's a panel of three. You got to be funny. So I get there, and I looked at the panel, and I said, oh, so I only got to be funnier than Tom Baudet. With no disrespect to Tom Baudet, I was pretty confident I could do it. And I did it, and it just fit. And Peter Sagal, after I did my first show, he said, that was one of the best first shows we ever had. And I think it was one of those things of me not knowing what it was, so I wasn't at all nervous.
I love that story. One can't ever argue against doing your homework, but there's something about bringing fresh perspective and not bringing some sort of weight of what you're supposed to do in that setting and just sort of letting your own natural instincts come out in terms of what kind of comedy you want to do.
I'll tell you, I have a friend, and jazz is my love and my passion, and through the jazz cruises and other work, I've worked with a ton of jazz musicians. Marcus Miller, jazz bassist, is a good friend of mine. And when he got the call to work with Miles Davis, he said he was in a session. They said it was Miles on the phone. He was like, it ain't Miles. Miles ain't played for years. And then he said Miles cussed him out on the phone. And that's when he knew it was Miles. And he had to get right over there and play this song. And he played it, and Miles liked it. And he ended up getting in Miles' band and working with Miles. And he said, listen, if I knew the night before I had to play with Miles Davis, I'd have been a mess. He said, just, you caught me in the moment. It's the same thing with Wait Wait. If you had told me beforehand, you know, this is one of NPR's biggest shows, there's 5 million listeners a week, and Tom Hanks is a guest host, and all, I'd have been like, I'd have been in my head thinking about it. It was perfect not knowing what I was walking into, because then there's no pressure.
And you just bring what you bring, and it worked. That's fantastic. I love that story.
I seem to have fooled them. I still don't know. People ask me how long I've been doing the show. I still don't know. It's 12 years, something like that, 30. I don't know. Long time.
Long enough to forget how long it's been. Well, I'm curious, what's the general approach to addressing, let's say, some of the harder truths of the world? Do you all have a sense of how you're going to handle the banter around the politics of any given week before you go on stage, or is there some free range there?
Well, here's the thing. Only one Trump joke per show, because it becomes so repetitive and boring, and it's the same thing over and over, the ridiculousness. You know, he'll tweet something in the middle of the night. If you just started doing that, that would dominate the show. So they kind of have an unwritten rule of only one Trump joke per show.
So there's always a panel for every show, and sometimes there are guest panelists and so forth, but there's a cohort of regulars on the show. And I wonder, you know, for all of us listening, it's this auditory experience of all of the back and forth. Let us inside a little bit. Are there any sort of visual cues you have between each other? Do you sort of know each other's rhythms really well at this point in terms of when to jump in and how to keep the conversations going?
Well, some people you know, and then other people you just pick up on it. So, for example, Paula is Paula. And Paula is going to keep going and going until you stop Paula. So we know that. So you can always jump in with Paula. Mo Rocca, Mo is my absolute favorite, because Mo has this weird circular logic when he's figuring out an answer. He starts at A and he goes through the entire alphabet to get back to A and then gives his answer. So I know that he's going to do that. Faith Saley, what you don't hear on the radio, just dirty. Just the woman's filthy. It's comical. And so, and I probably have some things that they would tell you about me. I always say that Paul is a singles hitter and I'm swinging for the home run. I'm waiting to hit the 3-run homer. That, I think, is the biggest difference between she and I. So, yeah, we kind of get to know each other and get to learn each other's rhythms on the show.
And now, panel, I have some questions for you about this week's news. Alonzo, you've heard of Real ID. Well, this week, the TSA released an advisory reminding people that they cannot get on flights using what?
As someone who flies all the time, this one even surprised me. You cannot fly using your Costco card.
That's right. Have you tried?
No, but I read the story and I was like, I can't believe they're doing, you know, I have all of it. You know, I have Clear, I have TSA PreCheck. In other words, I travel all the time. I'm getting through the airport. If I have to wait for you because you broke out a Costco card, we're gonna have a problem.
Plus, when you get off the plane, they go through your whole receipt, just checking that the flight was okay, which is a major time killer. Where my Costco head's at.
So we don't know where it's going. I think the biggest misconception is people think we have some idea of the show. We actually don't. The only thing we know in advance is the bluff, the listener story we get the day before, because two of us are going to have to write fake stories. But other than that, we don't know. And my favorite thing is there's always some question that I have no idea what they're talking about. You know, a naked man grocery shopping in Germany. I had that one time. I'm like, was I supposed to know about that? Last week we had a question about the poles on the sun. Did you know the sun has a north and south pole? Because I certainly didn't, nor did anyone sitting. Nobody knows that. And they're at, it's like, what do you stop it? You know? So there's always those questions. I learned a long time ago, it is more important to be funny than to be right.
Absolutely. In this case, funny definitely takes precedent over right. In the land of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And you have a robust career outside of the confines of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You've been doing stand-up for a very long time. And, you know, the world has changed a great deal since you first started doing stand-up. How has stand-up changed in that time? Since you first began, how has the art form of stand-up changed?
Well, I've been doing it 32 years, and obviously the biggest change has been social media. First with MySpace. By the way, when I did Last Comic Standing, I had more MySpace friends than you could shake a stick at, and unfortunately, they're all gone now. Yeah, then YouTube, and from now it's more TikTok is probably the dominant thing. So maybe the attention span has shortened. Someone asked me about a stand-up show on TV, and it's like, that would never work now because everyone just goes to TikTok or Instagram, and us old people go to Facebook, and you look for the comic you want, and you see their clips. So that's the big change in how it's consumed. I just missed the Johnny Carson era, which was, you know, in the 80s. If you were on Johnny and Johnny invited you to the couch, you were set. That was it. So basically, I was too young for Johnny and too old for social media. But that's the big change in stand-up. The other thing, this whole thing about the cancel culture is just so overblown. I've been trying, let me tell you something. If there's anything you guys can do to help me get canceled, I appreciate it. Because every time I see Dave Chappelle get canceled, I watch him do another $10 million special. And I just want one of those. So if you could do anything to get me canceled, I'd appreciate it. I'd love a $10 million deal from Netflix because I was canceled. People talk about the language and the, how should I put it, the sensibility of comedy changing. In other words, things you made fun of in the 90s, you're not going to make fun of today. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's true of all society. Like everything in society, the language has changed. The narratives have changed. The acceptance of various people, the acknowledgement of various things has changed. So stand-up changes with them, and in a lot of ways, changes ahead of them. And then other things, unfortunately, stay the same. It is a sad reflection of our society that everything George Carlin said is more true now than then.
Yeah, some of the stuff that stays evergreen, it's a little sad that it stays evergreen and relevant.
Oh, there was a period when I was really getting tired. I became a topical comic probably after Last Comic Standing. And then I got tired of it because we won't change. I'm still doing racism jokes. My jokes about our healthcare system being broken still work. The dumbing down of America is still happening. So I wish I didn't talk about those things. I wish I could say something about not having health insurance and people saying, what, are you crazy? Instead of, yeah, I feel that, you know. So it sucks. It sucks that our society doesn't move. I'll tell you the toughest thing in comedy now is satire. There's nothing you could say about Donald Trump that people wouldn't believe. So there's that. You know, this is the United States of America, and masked secret police are grabbing people off the street. And you just wouldn't have believed this 10 years ago, forget 20 years ago, if someone told you, oh yeah, they're banning books now, we're banning books out of libraries, we don't want the children reading, you'd have been like, well, what country is this? As someone posted in a meme showing ICE, said that if America saw America in another country, America would intervene.
It does feel sort of like the death of satire right now, or at least some sort of a hibernation of satire right now. Well, so let's talk about Hawaii. You're coming to Hawaii to perform at the Blue Note, one night only, June 25th. What's in store for the evening? Give us a sense of what you're bringing to the islands.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, there's no place cooler to do comedy than a jazz club, because jazz clubs just have a vibe. Big thing in common with jazz and comedy is improvisation, right? And being in the moment and just creating. And the room actually has a feel that is conducive to that. So I love doing comedy in jazz clubs. It's going to be great. The Blue Note is doing more and more comedians. I think they're realizing that synergy between comedy and jazz that really works. And I want you to know, if you look at resumes and history, I'm kind of leading that charge. I absolutely love doing comedy in the jazz world. So it's going to be a fun night.
That was comedian Alonzo Bowden talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson. Bowden will be performing two shows this Wednesday at the Blue Note in Waikiki. For more details, check out our website and at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, the Public Utilities Commission is looking into a whistleblower's complaint in a rate case. What's that about? Got some feedback for us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.